this idea of a kind of process of freeing the patient up to think as they please and to speak without selecting, without direction, is at the heart of the method that he devises. So there is an idea of freedom that's differentiated from compulsion from the start.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm a psychoanalyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Daniel Pick. Dr. Pick is a psychoanalyst and a fellow of the British Psychoanalytic Society. He read English literature and completed a PhD in history at Cambridge before moving to London University and undertaking his psychoanalytic training. He has worked for many years in private practice in London and has written widely on cultural history, the history of the human sciences, and psychoanalysis. He is, as you might gather from these accomplishments, a professor of history at Birkbeck University of London, and over the last 6 years, he has been the senior investigator on the Wellcome Trust-funded project, Hidden Persuaders, Brainwashing, Culture, Clinical Knowledge, and the Cold War Human Sciences, circa 1950 to 1990. This program explores the history of the human sciences and the psi professions and mind control fears during the Cold War. Dr. Pick has presented and contributed to a variety of radio and television programs, including for Radio 3, Brainwash Culture, and he also was a historical consultant for a 25-part BBC Radio 4 series, In Search of Ourselves, in 2014. As you will hear in today's interview, Dr. Pick, being both a psychoanalyst and a historian, allows him to go back and forth between historical influences and the psychoanalytic dyad, to learn about how the mind works in relation to our own histories and to the culture we live in. With great pleasure, here is my interview with Daniel Pick. Daniel, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, I'm pleased to have the chance to talk with you.
It seems to me that psychoanalysis and brainwashing are connected to each other in the same way that opposites often are. And what I mean by that is that brainwashing is an effort of one person or one party to take over the mind of another in order to have their own needs satisfied by that other. Psychoanalysis is an effort to free the mind of another so that they can more authentically identify what their needs are and choose to have them satisfied as they choose. Tell us about brainwashing. Tell us about its history. Tell us about your engagement with it, both as a historian and as a psychoanalyst. And share with us where we are now with your studies.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a long history to tell, and then there's a much more recent history to think about. That recently I've been struck in the last, let's say, 25, 30 years, that sometimes psychoanalysts, colleagues of mine, have felt it necessary to write essays or even, in one case, a book that insists that psychoanalysis is not brainwashing. I mean, as though the argument still needs to be made in the face of a critique which suggests that it might end up being something more like a mode of, if not brainwashing, hidden persuasion or coercive influence. And I think that this, in a way, debate about the differentiation of psychoanalysis from other forms of therapy that, if not brainwashing, are more, let's say, directive or coercive, or that seek to convert patients, has been going on really since Freud. And in fact, I was very struck. One of the things that I found fascinating was reading his autobiographical sketch, in the 1920s when he reflects back on his method and how he began with his own fascination with hypnotism and his trips to France to work with Charcot and Bernheim and others, and his abandonment of what he calls these techniques that, you know, around hypnosis, but where he ends up saying in the autobiographical sketch that psychoanalysis is precisely a method that eschews any effort at compulsion whatsoever, and that he, in a way, reflects back on the absolutely key ingredient, which is free association. So this idea of a kind of process of freeing the patient up to think as they please and to speak without selecting, without direction, is at the heart of the method that he devises. So there is an idea of freedom that's differentiated from compulsion from the start.
Do you think that one could take further what you're saying in that, from a technical point of view, the evolution from, as you say, hypnosis, and then there was a period of time in the development of psychoanalysis where id interpretations were given, where people were told the content of their repressed unconscious. And that has now evolved over time for what we in the States call defense analysis, so that one doesn't usually identify that which is conflicted, just the powers that lead it to be conflicted, ultimately giving more and more freedom to the person to discover their own insides.
Yes, I mean, I think, again, that that's in all the great figures in psychoanalytic history, one can see both of those ingredients, I mean, inspired by Freud, both the attempt to describe what is there, you know, to call a spade, to get to what the fantasy or the anxiety might be, and at the same time, the sort of effort patiently to point out or to explore the resistances, the defenses, all the factors that impede the patient from within at conducting this ideal that Freud sets up, which is to free associate in a way to sort of say what's on your mind and to know, you know, to know as best you can what's in your mind. I mean, he always recognizes that it'll never be complete. There will always be an unconscious there. It's not that he thinks it can be abolished, but the effort is to look at what kind of gets in the way of knowing and saying and sort of uttering. So yes, to analyze the defenses. And I think one of the other things that's striking is Freud's own conflict, because sometimes in his own writings about his cases, he does sound more directive. He sort of starts to sound more didactic, of sort of teaching the patient, even though in a way his methodology is to try to eschew that role as well and leave it to the patient.
There's always that tension, yes. But I interrupted you. You were saying about its history and your studies and where it's taken you now.
Yes, I think that Freud goes on being deeply interested in the question of influence. He doesn't, of course, have the word brainwashing, because the word brainwashing is only coined in the English language after Freud dies. It's coined in 1950. But he's very interested in the idea of forms of compulsion, either intrapsychically or interpersonally. So I think his interest in the sort of charismatic aspect of the hypnotist figure, of what the hypnotist can do and what the hypnotist represents to a patient, goes on fascinating him long after he says he gave up on trying to be a hypnotist because he says he wasn't very good at it, and he wants the patient to be fully awake and sort of, you know, mindful of what's going on. But in a way, the interest recurs, so that in his, I think, fascinating paper, Group Psychology, just after the First World War in 1921, you can see him returning to the kind of question of hypnosis in groups and the sort of suggestible nature of groups and how group psychology works. And I think in that paper and in many of his other papers, he's not only reflecting on politics and our interaction socially and politically and psychically, but also he's in a way reflecting on the problems of the psychoanalytic movement and the ideals of freedom and freedom of thinking inside the movement and the kind of other more archaic forms of identification and group dynamic or demonization or idealization that also afflict his own movement.
And he obviously, like you were saying, was intentional about it, because he both wished for people to have their autonomy and freedom, and yet at the same time was a very charismatic and at times very demanding leader of the group.
Yeah, and he sets limits on what is permissible. It's not that anything goes for him. And I think in one way, I think that's right. There have to be boundaries. I mean, just as now ethically, it seems right that there are you know, that there are boundaries about what is allowable within, you know, an ethical framework. On the other hand, the idea of a kind of freedom for people to express views and develop differently, and sometimes he was encouraging of those directions, and sometimes he was quite fierce and restrictive. And of course, you know, many of the schisms in the analytic movement, I mean, there's always at least two sides to those arguments, you know, whether it's Jung and Freud, or later Ferenczi and Freud, or Melanie Klein and Freud, or Anna Freud, you know, about how one sees the appropriate limits of freedom to take it in a different direction. Of course, later with Jacques Lacan and the International Psychoanalytic Association. So the question of allegiance and fidelity to a method and the freedom to develop it differently has always been a tension, I think, throughout the movement.
I've always been struck by those who try to make their theorizing data-based, that is clinical data, and those who just theorize off theory. And I think there's an important difference. But let's talk about your research, which it's not been specifically psychoanalytic. I mean, I'm in the middle of really enjoying your book on Svengali, who I actually knew nothing about till I learned about your writing. Like many others I've spoken with, we're under the impression that Svengali was a real character in the world, and he's not. He's a fictional character. So can you start us off back then on your interest in hypnosis and coercion and charisma?
Sure. I will come straight to Svengali, but just one word first. I mean, just in terms of my interest in the field and as a historian with my sort of two hats on, historian and psychoanalyst, I just sticking with the clinical for just one moment longer. I think I've always been impressed in my work with patients from my training onwards and through the last sort of 20 plus years I've been trying to work in the field, really, 25 years, is the question coming from patients too, which is about freedom. You know, one kind of anxiety might be if the analyst doesn't have a sufficiently boundaried and rigorous method or an appropriate training and a discipline. The other anxiety often is that the discipline could become, at its worst, a kind of constraint or discipline on the analyst that prevents the analyst from thinking independently and freely in their own right. So I think those tensions between the analyst pursuing a method that they've learnt and trained in the best sense, and the risk of a kind of, at worst, automatism or becoming like a kind of clone of others, of supervisors, of one's own analyst, of a tradition. Often that's something you can pick up subtly or grossly in the patient's question, which is, what are you going to do with me? Or how freely are you going to think? How freely are you going to allow me to think? And once or twice I've had patients who very directly posed the question of brainwashing, either, you know, about will this be brainwashing, or at its worst in the past, has analysis become something tantamount to that, like with so-called conversion therapy after the war. So that's one point of entry for me. The other, as you say, is historically that I've always, in a way, in my work, you know, teaching in a history department in the university and researching, been interested in cultural anxieties. And one area I got very interested in was sort of the Victorian period and the development of debates about, first of all, mesmerism, going back to Franz Anton Mesmer in Vienna, which was a century before Freud, and sort of late 18th century. There's a vogue for animal magnetism and mesmerism that comes back in the early Victorian period. So people like Charles Dickens get very intrigued about what can be done with that method therapeutically. So there's all of that going on. And then in a way, the kind of attempt medically to think about hypnosis afresh in that period, but in Britain, but also, of course, crucially in France. So that's a kind of debate that goes about whether it can be used as a technique and what are the dangers of hypnosis, of people losing their free will. It becomes a real anxiety in cultural debates about the hypnotist and also the political hypnotist. So I got to Svengali through that. I mean, partly there were a lot of anxieties, anti-Semitic anxieties about Disraeli, who was a charismatic conservative politician who became prime minister. He was also a novelist, but about his powers of enchantment. That preceded the creation of Svengali, who, as you say, was a fictional character. I got very interested in the novel that was called Trilby, that was written by Georges Du Maurier. It was kind of a forgotten novel now. But at the time, it was a huge bestseller, both in in the US and in the UK, there was a kind of, in a way, a craze around this novel. And at the heart of the novel is the story of a Jewish hypnotist, a poor man who comes from Eastern Europe to Paris with his hypnotic techniques, bound up in a way with his Judaism as well. He has the capacity really to mesmerize people, and through his gaze, under that power of his gaze, this young Irish woman called Trilby becomes a great opera diva. She can only sing in tune beautifully when Svengali has her in his power, literally in his eyeline. And that becomes the kind of figure, and the novel becomes this extraordinary sensation. So I ended up doing a book called Svengali's Web that was really about the kind of idea of this enchanting figure, this alien enchanter, with the sometimes indeed with a sort of Jewish dimension to an anti-Semitic dimension about the dangerous power of the Jews. And Svengali enters the language, I mean, he enters the English language, so he's in the dictionary to mean a kind of behind the scenes operator, often in the music business, but in any field we say a Svengali. It's almost an anagram of the word enslaving. So it kind of captured something. And anyway, so I got deeper and deeper into the story and why it became such a craze at that time in the 1890s, just before psychoanalysis was invented. And of course, it has so many connections and affinities because it was about the unconscious and both the, in a way, the creative power of the unconscious, but also the dangers of one person exploiting the unconscious of the other. In a way, it presages Freud's own anxiety that psychoanalysis will be typecast as a dangerous Jewish science. And it's one of the reasons that Jung is so valuable to Freud, the idea that through, you know, through bringing Jung into the movement, he can avoid the risk that it becomes a kind of enclave of intellectual Jews in Vienna. And of course, that goes, you know, it doesn't work out well in the end, but that's at least one of his ambitions in bringing in Jung as the kind of crown prince of the psychoanalytic movement.
And can you share with us how your studies of brainwashing have entered your clinical work, your office? You've mentioned patients that are afraid of being brainwashed. When you said that, I think I know what you're referring to. In my experience, what I have found is that the patients who are most concerned about being controlled by the analyst are those who themselves hold themselves so tightly controlled that they don't know it, but they project that onto the analyst. And their fears of outside control come to be revealed as how tight they are with themselves.
Yes, I think that's right, that often in the transference, but also often then in the counter-transference, the feelings were stirred up for the analyst. There can be, you know, one can sort of in a way come to see a picture of an internal world that may well reflect something the patient has always struggled with, you know, of sort of trying to work out a relationship to internal objects, but also to perhaps to a family history, or indeed a political history. If it's people coming from, you know, or a religious history, a fundamentalist background or whatever it may be, but where the question of freedom and coercion or rigid, you know, fundamentalist belief systems that hold things together, the fear of a kind of chaos if you step outside of it, or of, you know, a disaster if you are not rigidly following an authoritarian strict code, that these problems that patients may struggle with for all kinds of personal reasons then can play out in ways that I think differently for every patient. But I've also felt that, you know, that those questions, which sometimes can be have been put to me directly as, is this a form of brainwashing? Is it freedom? And if it's freedom, what are the risks of this freedom? I mean, sometimes it even has reminded me of Eric Fromm's fascinating, you know, great book called Fear of Freedom in 1941. The idea that we're not all just, you know, psychoanalysis said in its ideal may be about enhancing freedom, just as liberalism in its ideal form is about the sort of maximization of individual freedom, so long as your freedom isn't encroaching on someone else's, the sort of John Stuart Mill line. But we're all more ambivalent about freedom. And some people may have particular grounds to fear that if they give up on the rigid structure that holds them together, perhaps as a way of dealing with all sorts of problems, that if they lose that structure, they're left in a kind of even more disastrous, dangerous place. And then the kind of question of how, you know, how the analysis works to respect people's need for security or for certainties, whilst also being opening up the question of, you know, of why that's so, or could it be different? So I think that's often been true. And I feel, you know, in my own experience with patients, or thinking in my own analysis, the dilemma about how, about these questions, it's important. But I think it's also runs through the many of the great papers in classical psychoanalytic literature, sometimes, you know, in more neurotic form, sometimes in a more psychotic form. I mean, if one thinks of Victor Tausk's paper in, I think it's 1919, called The Influencing Machine, about schizophrenic patients. I mean, Tausk has this idea that often in the material of schizophrenic patients, there's this anxiety that both they and their doctors are actually being guided, are puppets really, of what's called the influencing machine that kind of guides their every thought. And so there's that, or I think in the Schreber case as well, but this sort of idea that not only the patient, but also the clinician, the question, are they free to think, or are they at the mercy of some kind of machinery that really dominates and influences their thinking apparatus?
Let me ask you a question about that. Going back to this trajectory of analytic technique from hypnosis to defense analysis, nowadays we come to include the countertransference very centrally in the dyad. And through projective identification, I certainly have had the experience, and I know others have written about it, about how one feels as analyst brainwashed by a patient. That is, that they take aspects of themselves that they can't recognize or tolerate and find some way to, as the saying goes, instill it in us so that we feel taken over by this badness in them, just to pick badness as a very common one. And it takes some real self-analysis and, in my own experience, self-stabilization to locate where I am versus where the patient is, to right my analytic ship so that I can see where the influence is coming from and where it isn't. Do you think that's a fair use of the term brainwashing in terms of projective identification, or does it lose any focus when considering that?
There's so much, Harvey, in what you're saying there. I mean, it's to think about. I mean, I'm reminded of Freud's, you know, that famous sort of end point of his BBC interview in 1938, where he says the struggle is not yet over as his end point. And I think that that is a struggle to extricate, you're saying, in a way, to extricate oneself enough to hopefully, if all goes well, to sort of see the degree to which perhaps hitherto one's been pulled in, or in a particular session, to a kind of unconscious drama with a patient where one is an auxiliary or a player in their internal world, if you like, where one's got caught up in becoming the interlocutor. In it might be in a kind, I mean, people have written, other people have written about this, of course, very eloquently, about, you know, the situation where the analyst may feel they're in a kind of police state or in a fascist polity, either as the brainwashed victim of the patient's coercive controlling influence, or treated as though they are the kind of fascistic, you know, demagogue or you know, police captain. And then the question, is it true? I mean, there's, because the patient may treat one as though one is, let's say, an authoritarian dominating figure, and it may not be an accurate depiction of what the analyst thinks is going on. Or it may be, as you're saying, it may be that one has been nudged or moved into a position where one is more this or that, you know, let's say more authoritarian than one might normally be. And I thought, I mean, again, just to think of great papers on this, I mean, Freud and in the Ratman case, you know, the question about, you know, the patient's fear that the analyst is sort of omniscient and omnipotent and can see right into his brain. And also the way in which Freud has to be a player in the Ratman's own sadistic, sort of sadomasochistic drama. And maybe Freud even becomes, you know, I think it's quite interesting the way Freud even becomes rather dogmatic in that paper, sort of tells the rat man what he's got to do. He must reveal, he must confess his secrets, Freud says at one point. I mean, sort of in a way, rather dictatorially. So I think that you can see that sort of template, and the problem of that. Yes, I think in one's own practice all the time, the question of, is one still thinking analytically, or has one been sort of maneuvered, for whatever reason, into a sort of role?
And how we can reflect on that for the benefit of understanding the patient.
Yeah, exactly. So that it may be that that's a very crucial process to go through, that the patient may need, may require the analyst in a way to suffer that experience or to endure something or to struggle with the dilemma. Are, you know, am I free? Is this me or is it you? What's going on? And that if, as you say, if that can be faced and known about, let's say the analyst does have the wherewithal to notice, perhaps with, you know, through their own reflection on it or through a supervision or through a discussion with a colleague or just through, you know, in a way, sleeping on it, it can then become food for thought, a kind of means to then explore with the patient what has, of course, in microcosm, it might be even during a session that the analyst can recover enough to notice what has just happened, that they've become, let's say, you know, the sort of, you know, cast in this more brainwashing style role or as the brainwashed victim. And then that that can be put, turned into an interpretation. And that's, I think, has become absolutely central to the way people, you know, we now work, is to try to use those moments as then the means to think with the patient wherever possible.
And how often we find a history of trauma in those patients that are able to induce in us either side of their being traumatized, either us as the traumatizer or us as the traumatizee.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, and that can be in an extreme sense of somebody who suffered the most horrendous cruelty, let's say, or terror in a family, in a, Robert J. Lifton calls a closed milieu, a sort, you know, conducive to brainwashing, or in a political state of terror. And that it may be in those more gross forms, I mean, in those more dramatic forms, or in more subtle forms, the question of, you know, the freedom of maneuver to think or to doubt, to have uncertainty, to move around in your own mind, let alone in society, with some modicum of freedom, that that often is a feature then that will be kind of, as it were, revealed in the course of an analysis.
Well, let me ask you about that. It seems to me that there's an important differentiation because, in a way, we all live brainwashed. And by that, I mean all of us come from a culture, whether it be a political culture, a ethnic culture, a religious culture, and all these cultures that we are born into and raised in, by definition, influence what we look at and what we don't look at, what we have reactions to and what we don't have reactions to. Every family does that. That's how a family becomes a unit. You sort of take on a family language and a family way of thinking. And ultimately, of course, we end up doing that to ourselves in our own repressions. We are sort of brainwashing ourselves, if one could say that, in that we will not acknowledge certain things inside ourselves, and we will acknowledge others. So how does one draw a line between, if you will, malignant brainwashing and commonplace survival brainwashing?
Just to start with the language you've just used, there's a rich language in psychoanalysis to think about the spectrum, let's say, between the ideal of autonomous thinking, of free, let's say, freedom to think, and brainwashing at the other extreme. And in a way, much of the vocabulary about projection, identification, idealization, splitting, denial, you know, and self-projective identification, of course, the transference, all of these terms lend themselves to thinking about that large spectrum of possibility. At the same time, what I have found myself researching for a book I'm now trying to write, you know, I've been running this project for the last few years at London University, funded by the Wellcome Trust, on the history of brainwashing.
You should mention the website and we'll put it in the notes.
Yeah, the website, if people are interested, is called Hidden Persuaders. If you Google Birkbeck Hidden Persuaders, you'll find it. And we named it slightly archly in sort of homage to Vance Packard's famous book of 1957, which was one of the, you know, works of the 50s on persuasion, called The Hidden Persuaders. It was about advertising, the psychology of advertising. What I was just going to say, though, is that it's sort of in parallel to the psychoanalytic vocabulary that we have, there's also a more, there's another set of ideas sort of in popular culture and in other areas, you know, of the human sciences about that spectrum, that range of possibility that, you know, that I think are interesting to think about or to use as concepts to think with about all of this. I mean, we talked earlier, you know, mesmerism, indoctrination, you know, suggestion, you know, crowd psychology, the stuff I was interested in about the Victorian period. But once one moves forward in time into the interwar period, the war years and the Cold War, it becomes again a very salient theme in modern Western culture. The ideal of the term that's used in the 1940s is the free world. In contrast, and it's used by Roosevelt, by Truman, it's used by, in cinema, Frank Capra, we are the free world pitted against fascism and Stalinism and so on. So there's a kind of idea of the ideal of freedom. And then there's this sort of range of possibilities of how that freedom to think is undermined politically as well as socially and psychically. So there's, I mentioned Fromm's book, Fear of Freedom or Escape from Freedom. It had two different titles. There's Adorno's The Authoritarian Personality in 1950. And then there's, in 1950, there's this coinage, brainwashing. And, I've had this group at Birkbeck of younger researchers, postdocs, doctoral students, and we've really delved into this history of the language and culture and scientific take-up of this notion that comes in brainwashing, which was originally meant to be a translation of a Chinese term. It was meant to be a Maoist technique of sort of washing the brain, or re-education, as it was known. And the fear was that what communism was doing, at least this version of communism, was wiping out people's memories, people's prior set of, reference points, associations, and a kind of new form of scientific indoctrination that was rendering people into sort of stooges or simple, were sort of zombies of the new system. So brainwashing was the term that kind of gained currency in the 50s. First of all, about Mao and China and the fate of POWs who were held by the North Koreans and the Chinese, including a small group of American POWs who at the end of the Korean War, to the consternation of their Western, of Western officialdom and many of their fellow soldiers, chose, apparently of their free will, to not to go home, but to live in Mao's China, to go to, over to the enemy, as it were. There were many prisoners on the other side who chose the West or chose South Korea or Taiwan. But this became a huge story that 21 American GIs and one solitary British soldier decided to live in China. And they became the sort of eye of the storm of the brainwashing literature, which ends up in movies like The Manchurian Candidate. And then there are other terms like hidden persuaders, like groupthink, like menticide, which was sort of coined in the 50s. There was a book called The Rape of the Mind as well. But this idea that there was something tantamount to genocide that could be called menticide, the murder of the mind, that was first of all located in either in theories about Maoism or theories about Stalinism, or retrospectively applied, to the confessions, like in the Moscow show trials of the 30s, the mystery of kind of confession under interrogation. But these ideas, this range of ideas also starts to kind of in a way boomerang back or get mirrored back on the West to think about the more, at least the question of the freedom in the so-called free world to think independently for yourself. Hence the idea like of groupthink in 1952, when that word's coined to describe the possibility that corporate capitalism, not in a totalitarian sense, but just by creating these vast business empires, might be modifying and ultimately sort of in a way unifying the way everyone thinks to produce a state of groupthink.
Daniel, the pleasure of talking to you, and I would like to go on, is to discuss cases. And what you, because of your historian background, is able to do is to bring not only the clinical moment alive, but also relate it to cultural moments and historical moments, which even adds to the psychoanalytic richness. Unfortunately, we can't carry on now, at least not at this point. But I do want to thank you both for your research, which, as I said, I'm enjoying enormously. I also read your book on Rudolf Hess. And your also intro book on psychoanalysis, all of which I've enjoyed, and I do recommend to our readers. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. I am certainly better educated as a result of it. I'm sure many of our listeners will feel the same. And I look forward to our keeping in touch. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss it.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.